Hopefully this will suffice for recording.
Whatever. I'm not going to go out of my way to talk any.
Right. Sitting right next to you.
All
right.
Arr! Freaking. Damn you. Freaking damn you all to hell. Anyways. Okay.
Control L should do full screen if you don't want
it. It goes over here. It's not Zinnerama. Oh. All right. So, oh no. And it's not even. Oh, man. Freaking. Oh. Ah.
If you click the little arrow next to it, you can help it.
Oh, this, yes. Fit width. No. Fit full height. Page.
I think the fit full width.
Page my butt! Like, freaking.
Because the windows.
Oh,
the windows
I know why. Off. I know why. That problem.
X render dash dash auto?
It's worse than that. Okay. Oh, crikey. Okay,
okay, that's good.
Yeah. That's more reasonable.
Let's go with this.
Anyways, okay, so this is basically our essential setup. We have sort of three layers of horror. The first one is the load balancers. So this is the Linux virtual server cluster we have going. And basically, everything gets funneled generally through LB1, which is the master load balancer. And then there's also LB2, the backup load balancer. And these guys are basically talking back and forth constantly. And should LB1 ever go down, LB2 will steal all its IP addresses. And there are some, quote, virtual IP addresses, which are basically the IP addresses of the services, of the service front ends, which are the things that get swapped around. So this is always LB1, this is always LB2. But there's www1 and 2, and www-contrib 1 and 2. Which will get bounced between these as one goes down. As it happens, I think this one was down earlier today. Who knows? Oh, excellent. Okay. So it was doing nothing at all, but this is how it is now. So this is new as of probably the last 6 months, maybe. Previous to that, we just had these two layers.
So WW1 is not an actual machine?
It is a VHO. Woo. It is. An IP address that is bound to these guys, but that is routed through these front ends.
So,
if you SSH to LB1, you'll get this guy. If you SSH to LB2, you'll get this guy.
Okay.
If you SSH to www1, you.
I'm not.
God,
exactly
it actually
sure.
Kicks you right back out. I've tried it.
Okay.
You actually can't SSH to any of the www machines directly, or these host names, anyways.
Why not?
Well, because these are virtual IPs where only specific ports are redirected.
Okay, so
if you do 22, it just goes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So no, they don't really correspond to real machines. Like the real machine they correspond to could get moved around.
Yes.
Okay.
They never really correspond with them.
Yes.
Their machine.
So I can say a little bit more about the virtual services stuff. But let me go through the rest of it first. But essentially, yeah, to what you're asking. So there are two DNS A records for each of there are two DNS A records for www.club, which are both of these www1 and 2 IPs. So if you go to www.club, you'll get round robin to one of these two IPs. And same for www.contrib.andrew, one of these two IPs. This is a historic thing. All four of those IPs are bandwidth exempt. And previous to the load balancer existing, those were assigned directly to the front ends.
Okay,
like,
so www.node1 is the actual front end, and it is not bandwidth exempt.
Right.
That's right.
Okay.
But any traffic that it uses through these IPs is.
Okay.
So there is actually a like localhost or virtual interface or some garbage on these two that actually have all of these IPs bound to them.
Say that again?
So isn't this the case? Yeah. So both of these machines. Right. Yeah. Both of these machines have an IP tables redirect rule so that any traffic they receive to any of these four IPs, they steal, basically.
So if I'm on www.node1,
yes.
And try and access www.1, it'll do the right thing. As in, go back
to localhost.
Instead of going through a load balancer and possibly doing something weird.
Maybe.
Well, one of two things will happen. Either you go straight to localhost, or you'll end up going through the load balancer, and it should just work.
Okay, but it should still hit the machine that I'm currently on.
No, it'll hit one of the back. Right, right. If it gets sucked in by localhost, you'll go right back to the current machine. If it goes through the load balancer, it'll go to whichever of those two the load balancer feels like sending you to.
And why would it do one versus the other?
Well, because it round robins requests, and in theory, it can be arbitrarily fancy, like checking load average, upness, stuff like that.
Okay.
Right now, it's just like, are they both up? If they're both up, round robin. That's it.
Okay.
So.
No, I mean, why will it sometimes go to localhost?
Oh, not sometimes. It's a matter of trying it. It's one or the other. It's deterministic, but I don't know which will happen.
Okay.
It depends on, like, what layer of the kernel all this horror is actually happening in. Yeah. Okay, so previous to the load balancers existing, we just had the front ends. And so this front end was www1 and www.contrib1, and this one was the same thing, 2. And then the DNS would just bounce between these two. This had the effect that if one of them went down, in theory, 50% of the requests would still work. But in practice, like, your browser would end up caching the IP address. And you'd get the one that was down. Exactly, yeah. So in theory, this is a better setup. And, well, in particular, so the front ends are the things that actually run Apache. I should actually be looking at my notes here. Eek. Oh, no. God.
I think you can stop that.
Why don't I just make that go away? Anyways, point made. All right. All right. So yes, the front ends are the things that actually run Apache. And so, like, they have AFS clients. And when AFS gets sad, they get sad. The thing with load balancers is I don't even think they're running AFS clients.
Nope.
And so they're unaffected by any such garbage. So,
for instance, the backup one runs in 64 megabytes.
God. Okay. But basically, so there are various things that will make the front ends go down, and so it's kind of nice to have this.
Like AFS as well.
Yeah, basically. So just at a high level, I'm going to say a bit about Apache or CGI setup, PubCookie, MyContrib, ContribKey, and some other crap.
So what?
Well, at a high level, I'm going to go through the details of all these, but for now, I'm just going to say these are the ones running Apache, and they have an AFS client, and they serve static web pages. So anything that's like an HTML, anything that's not a CGI in AFS. So they do club, www.club, they do www.contrib. They are also, the FTP server's on these, right?
Yep.
And it just bounces.
FTP and rsync.
Yeah.
FTP and what?
Rsync. So if you hit our FTP server, you'll get this too. And that just goes out to AFS as well. And so these things are doing some magic, which I'll explain more in a second, to basically figure out if a request is for a CGI script. And if it's on contrib, it will send it to the contrib CGI server. And if it's for a club user, it'll get sent to the club CGI server. So that way, if someone traces the contrib CGI server, like club users don't get affected. In practice, it's kind of meaningless, and actually, I think these people pound it more. And then there's something else, which is MyContrib, and I'll show you that, and that's kind of the sort of user configuration page for contrib stuff. And this is actually directly bound to contrib CGI, and so if you go to it, you will bypass all of this and go straight to this machine. There's no load balancing, whatever, other magic.
So no load balancing on contrib.
MyContrib.
On MyContrib.
Yeah. So in general, you never hit contrib CGI directly. Like, if you request a CGI script via contrib, you will go all the way through this. Now let's say a few words about Linux virtuals, or whatever they call them, Linux virtual services.
Give me just a second to write this down.
I can give you this diagram. Yes.
I mean, I'm copying what you're saying, not what's on the board.
No, that's good. That's fine. That's fine.
I have a note here. There
in
is
fact,
a diagram I'm expecting you to send.
Sure, sure. In fact, as it happens, Lurchy actually really wanted to come to this, but he had a prior engagement. So. He did. That's what he said. Yeah. He's dying to know about our infrastructure.
People that I've not met that I would like to
see. I know. He's a famous enigma himself. So Lurchy, by the way, is a good friend in the information security office. If you do anything you really shouldn't, you'll probably get a mail from him someday. And I now have conclusive evidence that he really does spend all his days dealing with, like, MPAA crap. Mm-hmm. Poor guy. Anyways, so Linux virtual services is kind of scary. It's reasonably well documented on their website. Was it linuxvirtualservices.org or something like that?
I don't even know what that what it
is. Okay, so it's basically, it's this kind of load balancing scariness, where you have, like, some virtual service, and then you have a bunch of backends that are actually serving it. And this is something big that's done by, like, every company. And they usually use a product called Cisco Local Director to do it. And it's literally just this box, and you program it with, like, all your backends, and say, like, when something comes in on port 80, it'll pick a backend that's up to send it to. And it can, like, it'll ping the backends, make sure they're up. It'll actually make fake requests, make sure they're up. You can get arbitrarily fancy. Like I said, you can have a script that checks load average, whatever, that kind of thing.
So what do we use this for? What do we use Linux virtual services for on Contrail?
That's the load balancers.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, that's the technology behind the load balancing.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Take care. And there are a few ways that this can be implemented. What the hell is the first one? Oh, yeah, right. Tunneling. NAT, right. So an obvious one is, a way this can be implemented is direct NAT, or network address translation, and that is, it's kind of, I'm going to say, it's not, well, sorry, just for those of us that are not that familiar with it, it's sort of the same idea as, like, a home router box that gives you fake IP addresses in your house and then kind of figures things out so that you can make requests and it comes back to the machine that actually requested it. But basically, like, a request would come in on port 80. All the real IP addresses are literally bound to this machine. So this is an option which we're not using. I'm just explaining it.
Right.
So, okay. And then all the backends have fake IP addresses. And there are a couple ways you could, and then there's, like, a fake IP address on this side of the machine, essentially. And you can think of it as there's an obvious way you can do it, which is you set these guys to use this guy's fake IP address as a router, as their next hop gateway. And that way, when a request comes in off the net, it picks a backend and then basically forwards it on to one of the fake IP addresses. And so what these guys basically see is, oh, some guy out on the net with some real IP address requested something from my fake IP address. And then when he replies, he goes back out through this guy, who then rewrites the IP address again.
Right. Like standard.
Yeah. Yes. You can also do it the crappy way, which it makes it look like all requests are actually coming from this guy's fake IP address. But that's no fun, because then you can't do statistics and stuff. The major kind of icky part about that is that it puts more load on this guy.
All traffic has to go through him.
Like, it literally has to be their gateway.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like, yeah, so you get the load in and the load out. And a property it does have is that in the case of a need to failover, all his state is going to be lost. Because he's the one keeping the connection table, right? So that is a pretty fundamental problem with all the approaches, I think, and our approach still fails that. But in a web server setup where the connections don't last very long, it's kind of okay to drop a connection. In fact, this is definitely Google's philosophy. Like, I don't know, I've definitely seen, you know, sorry pages from Google, and it's basically like, sorry, your request landed on a backend that's dead, try again, and then it works the next time. They don't mind dropping single requests on the floor, it just really needs to work the next time. So that's philosophy. Another way to do it is to have these guys have as their router the real router, so like, you know, just configured as they were with the real IP address, and then have this guy have the and then this guy has the virtual IPs that so the requests actually go to these guys, but then these guys also have those IPs. Similar, essentially this setup, except for one thing. So when a request comes in, he goes, aha, I'll pick a backend. And then he actually uses IP tunneling, but in the sort of in the least fancy way. So there isn't some sort of VPN going on. It's literally you take the IP packet and you stick a new IP header on the front that says actual destination backend. And what the backend does is it receives that packet and goes, oh, this is an encapsulated packet. Let's rip off the top and go, oh, okay, so this is a packet from the guy out there to my virtual IP. I'm going to process
directly.
It. And it responds directly, yeah. And so something about that is that you need all these machines to support this kind of IP tunneling, this encapsulation. You get more fragmentation because you can't fit as much data in the packets. You have to stick another IP header on the front. And so if it was a full-size packet already, you have to break it up. And so it's just kind of a little messier, more work. I mean, it's nothing it's nothing we would deal with, but it's just a little more load. It's just messier philosophically. But it does have the property that these machines can actually now be located all over the globe, because you're actually sending a proper IP packet to these guys, you know, that will be routed, and it can go anywhere. There's one caveat to that, though, which is when they respond directly, they're responding directly as the virtual IP. And so if I have this machine located in some data center in China, there can't be like spoofing prevention somewhere along the way to prevent me from sending a packet with this IP address that is, quote, actually located here, if that makes any sense. So like basically all these machines have to be able to send out packets from that. So there's actually a shortcut to that scenario, which is if they all happen to lie on the same Ethernet segment, you don't actually have to stick a whole nother IP header on. You can actually just send out a raw Ethernet packet to the backend's MAC address with the destination IP being the service IP, which this guy recognizes. So he basically gets an Ethernet packet that looks like it came from, you know, the router out there. Except it actually went through this guy.
Is that what we're doing?
That is what we're doing.
Okay.
Of course, it's the most complicated.
Yes, it's the most complicated. There's a little bit of a problem, which is because they're on the same Ethernet segment, when these guys start responding with the virtual IP, you're going to potentially mess up the ARP MAC address tables of everybody and the switch. And so I believe it's actually configured. Well, the details don't matter, but it's essentially configured so that these guys don't ARP.
So the front ends don't ARP at all?
No, the front end does, the back ends don't. This guy always looks like it has the IP.
The column says front end there, the middle
yes.
column there. Like, those
Lord,
don't
yes.
Those don't ARP.
These are called front ends for historical reasons, yes. Yes,
okay.
Yes, yes. Very good. Okay, so that's kind of that. And at this point, I can say a little bit more about our actual configuration, essentially. So we run, or at least we try to run, Debian Apache on everything now. I'm not sure what's... I cannot...
I believe this is the case.
Okay, I can't vouch for this being the case on every machine, but it's our plan and intention. And as far as the configuration, so now I'm going to say a few words about the Apache configuration. Lordy, why is this? Okay, interesting. Okay, so I don't expect this to make complete sense, but I'm just going to kind of go through it anyways. So this is, so all the Apache configuration stuff, well, either lies or at least is symlinked in var apache etc.
place where?
Apache OT. So I perceive that this machine is not running Debian Apache. Debian Apache either has it in Etsy Apache or Etsy HTTPD, but I think we still set up some links so that this path always is valid. Anyways, so okay, so I'm just going to zip through it. So basically all of the magic is done with Apache rewrite rules, which we have a lot of.
What file is this that you currently have on screen?
This particular file is for Apache Etsy contrib.conf. So there's... So the Apache configuration file...
is basically the default for a number separate
from... is pretty standard, and then just kind of includes all our vhosts. So this is the contrib vhost config file.
So our master configuration is standard.
Fairly standard, yeah.
Fairly standard, but includes vhosts that do a lot of magic.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So the root, sort of the HTTP root for it, is this, which is unreasonably long. Really, it's just AFS club www contrib, although this might be the official mounted AFS path, whatever. But basically, it's AFS club contrib. This is the root of contrib.
AFS.
Sorry. Yeah.
And that's all the symlinks.
This is literally like the document root. So like if you know index.html lies in there.
Okay.
And the scary symlinks. I'm so not going to ls this 6 megabyte directory, but 600k. Never mind, that's not so bad. The symlink tree kind of looks like that. So for every Android user, there it symlinks to their home directory /www. This is synced up with the Android password file. In fact, here you can see 5am's copy of the Android password file. And so basically, it literally it stores yesterday's password file, diffs it against the current password file, and then makes the appropriate changes. So deleting and adding some links. All three of these work. So, you know, twiddle me /user/me/user/me. So, okay.
So I understand that those work. Where is that in the configuration file?
Where that is in the configuration file is... a bunch of scary rewrite rules. So, the typical one is the following.
Just a second.
Sure. Okay, so this is literally the rewrite rule that makes that happen. As you can see, it's not very exciting.
If you don't understand rewrite...
Rewrite is very well documented.
Okay, can you say in one sentence what that rewrite rule translates to?
Rewrite a request for,
tilde something
to var Apache user that.
Okay.
And then... this is the crap that makes user and user. No, sorry, wrong one. Bah. This is the crap that makes user and user do its thing, mainly for compatibility with www.andrew, because I think they generally don't use tilde; they use /user. And then there are a lot of little silly fixes like crap like this, which just kind of give you the expected behavior. I'll say that much. Okay. Okay, so for orgs, the same thing happens. So there's an Andrew org directory, which is AFS Andrew org, And so this is basically like, there's a vegetarian club. It's amazing.
There's a vegetarian club?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not part of this club.
Because apparently they died off in 1992.
I can revive them.
Dude, vegetarian lentil bake. Lentil loaf. That
Yo,
looks disgusting.
They have recipes?
Yeah.
Send me these recipes. I need recipes. Recipes.
I have
I
think this is
stuff.
The only one, but...
Awesome.
Okay. Wow.
Maintain a shape better than meatloaf, yuck. Wow, these are like serious veg heads.
Meatloaf
okay.
is pretty disgusting. I'm not
gonna... I might agree with that.
You guys don't use the right... It's not a list. It's actually... So, yeah, organizations can, like, request org directories, and they end up here. And so, like, yeah, you can get space here. And then in each of those... what's a good one? Whoa. They can also set permissions. But they can have a www directory. And so we basically serve in the intuitive way... So if you say /org/whatever, you'll get... So this is also a symlink tree in exactly the same way. So you'll get that. And then we actually have sort of a user and org index. I think the org index is, oh my god, out of date.
Why do we use the symlink tree instead of rewriting it to...
Straight out of it?
User or something.
I'm going to say because... I think symlinks bypass this scary directory walk. So when you make a request via to an Apache web server for like /a/b/c/d/e.html, it looks in /a, it then looks in /b, and walks its way up.
And we'll try to list AFS and re users.
Yes.
And like explode.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty
it's
much
probably
it.
It's also a little bit easier on their AFS servers because /user really isn't /user. Like, /user kind of redirects you to like a...
Yeah, so that's the other thing. It avoids a... It sort of avoids a layer of redirection because, as you might have seen... You know, it's...
That's also something.
Yeah, that's also something. Yeah, so... And we actually symlink to the right volume. So, okay. And there's actually a Perl script that syncs up the ergers with our symlink tree, obviously.
Yeah, and it does the same thing with, like, instead of using the password file, it just lists the directory and
exactly.
And
yeah.
Yep. Which
yep.
Okay.
So we have a magic program called iscgi.pl. And every request, the path for the file, gets sent to standard input of this script, which then spits out 1 or 0 on standard out. Or is it a CGI?
Our Apache is CGI.
It's
yeah.
built in script.
Does this does Perl stay like loaded in the background?
Yes.
Okay.
It actually has like a bunch of them persistently running.
Right.
In it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Return 0 or 1 if 0 if it's not CGI?
Yes. It is called the is CGI script. Hopefully
well,
not the is
active
not CGI
low,
script.
Active high, right?
It's not called the is not CGI script. and so there are two ways you can send argument or there are a number of ways you can send arguments to CGI scripts. One of them is like the post thing where you basically request it and then spit a bunch of crap. The other is you can add crap on the end of the path. And traditionally, it's, you know, .cgi ?
Right.
Foo arguments. But there's an old style, which we still have people using, which is foo.cgi /arg1/arg2/arg3.
That's an awesome style. I love that style.
And as you might imagine, it could, like, really mess things up. And
because Apache doesn't do it fast.
It, well, no, it
or
sort of does. Yes, yeah. It destroys regexes, obviously. And so in lieu of horrible regexes, we actually... The script actually sort of does a directory walk of its own in the reverse direction and just, like, stops when it gets to an actual CGI.
And the reverse directory walk, and
this
is
reasonable.
It's remarkably reasonable, actually.
I also kind of like being able to use slashes instead of...
Yes, yes. So there's a famous one, which is the following. And the first time... I set up my initial version of all of this, Isildur went, ooh! And he created a directory called index.cgi. And then requested a directory listing of this directory.
Did it work?
No, it went into some horrible infinite loop.
Wait, why does that cause it to explode?
It doesn't anymore.
It doesn't anymore.
Why did that cause it to explode?
Because I was using regexes instead of... Well, any intuitive way you would think of... Any naive intuitive way you'd think of handling this will break some perverse way. Potentially that way.
Okay.
So I'll,
we
yeah.
Like, we just say buff it with the regexes.
Right.
And
we do it...
Is CGI,
yeah.
Like, can stack the files...
Yeah, and it literally does.
On.
Yeah, yeah. And so in particular, we handle all the icky cases that I can possibly imagine. And in particular, we handle index.cgis, index.php.
Why do we have to handle them specially?
Well, because it's a directory listing, but it's a CGI. Well, so we have to detect... So if you have index.cgi in a directory, and you just request the directory, we want it to serve that CGI. But on the surface of it, it would just look like a directory. And the front end would try to serve it and go, oh, no, it's a CGI. I'm not allowed to serve CGIs. So just break. So we actually explicitly check for, are you requesting the directory? And so, like, you know, is your request a directory? And is in that directory there's something called index.cgi? And then if there is, rewrite your request to the actual CGI. That's all that says. And then we actually run that CGI.
For CGI, index.cgi has to be a file, which is the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. PHP, so anything.cgi and anything.php is considered an executable CGI script. .pl isn't, .rb isn't. We actually just serve the source of those. This is primarily because PHP has had this ridiculous convention of, like, .php is, like, always executable. The other ones, it's a toss-up whether you actually mean to execute it. And so for the others, we say, if you mean it to be executed, you have to name it .cgi.
Okay. Okay, so let me take a step before I forget. We specialize index.cgi and index.php, so we can run them automatically when you list the directory.
Yes.
Without exploding.
Yes.
We only serve executable files named in .cgi or .php.
Yes. So
that's what the next two lines do. Next two lines.
He really didn't want to see those. So what these lines do is, is CGI
honest.
On the request say one? And if it says one, then... and... it's a request for something.cgi, then send it to the contrib CGI server. But in particular, proxy it. So don't tell the user, oh, go to contrib CGI. Literally proxy it.
Okay.
And Apache actually has a built-in proxy that will do this.
Okay, so is CGI returns
Sorry?
True?
No, it's built. It's mod proxy.
CGI returns true, and...
It's a CGI. And it looks like... And it's in the path so that it's a CGI.
It's pretty clear.
Proxy to true CGI.
Yeah. So this has the effect that contrib CGI sees all requests actually appearing to come from front ends. There's no NAT going on, no address rewriting of any kind. They literally, like, all requests seem to come from the front end. This is suboptimal. Ideally, we wouldn't have it do this. But honestly, like, it was the easiest thing to do, and nobody's complained yet.
Why is that? Why would that be bad?
Well, if you have a CGI script, which, for one thing, it kind of sucks for statistics on the CGI server. Say you're definitely not checking your phone. I'm gonna keep talking.
Yeah.
It's kind of bad because if you want to do statistics on CGI server, they'll look like they're from one host. The other is sometimes a script wants to know who's requesting it, maybe authentication, maybe just statistics of its own.
Which a script I wrote did, but like there's a PHP environment variable, and those what?
Yes. So, well, in particular, the front end actually adds it's in the HTTP headers. It's like X forwarded for,
right.
And then the real host, and it actually shows up as an environment variable that you can access via Perl, PHP, whatever. Like it's a proper Unix environment variable. It's actually documented in the contrib stuff on our services documentation on the website, not the wiki.
And PHP does the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's that. So that's pretty much that. Now, wandering over to contrib CGI. So let's see. So CGI scripts are actually executed by a local user that's unique to each user.
Sorry, just a second. I think I screwed this up.
Sure.
I can fix it later.
Okay. So CGI scripts are executed by a user on contrib CGI that's unique to each user. So you can't trample on each other. Like, you can't kill each other's processes, whatever, that kind of thing. If you create temp files, you can't need each other's temp files.
So every Android user has an account with contrib CGI?
Yes. It has a really big password file. So the way we do this is there's basically a Perl script which checks the Andrew password file, takes the Andrew UID, and adds, you know, pound-defined big number to it.
It takes the Andrew password file and, like, adds a user on the Twitch CGI.
Yeah. So this machine, so there's a lot of password files on this machine.
Right.
So our password update script concatenates them all into password.
Right.
Most machines don't have a password.contrib. This one does. We take the original UID and add some just big offset to it. I don't know what it is, but... is that... What?
Interesting.
Anyways, so in particular, this has the effect that when the Andrew password file gets, like, scrambled around or whatever, or new users get added, you actually retain your UID. It's persistent. Because Andrew doesn't change the UIDs, and so we just add an offset to it. So...
Okay. So if this were blown away, it could be rebuilt exactly, and you would retain your UID.
Yes, yeah. In particular, if a script is running while the password file gets changed, nothing bad happens because your UID isn't changed. That was the big thing I was looking for. I have no idea. I fingered him. Okay, so remember the Andrew org directories?
Yeah.
Well, so those are what, well, each org directory gets its own CGI user as well. And so what we do there is we have an awesome script which generates unique names that don't collide for each of those that are prefixed with A for Andrew org. And then, you know, as much of the username will fit in 8 characters. And so there is a terribly amazing Perl script where we basically iterate, and then we take the string and we plus plus it, because you can do that in Perl.
What?
It does exactly what you think it does.
It's kind of cool.
What do I think it does?
It increments the string.
Wow.
It's awesome. Anyways.
I was only watching with you.
So then, yeah, so that's that. And actually...
So the names and the UIDs of the orgs are stable as well?
Yes. Yes. There is some...
Why not?
It's a way to automatically... It's like, generate obvious username based on org directory name. If it exists, or while that exists, plus plus, try again.
Okay.
That's basically the logic.
Okay.
So that only occurs if there's a collision.
Yes.
Okay. So it might not be stable if the collision goes the other way. Like if it gets reordered, if the password file gets like reordered or something by Andrew,
then they all have to be reordered.
The organization is not in the Andrew password file.
I'm making the assumption that there will never be an Andrew user called aorg.
No,
something.
I mean, if I have OR A and OR B and they collide,
yes.
Then B always comes after A, so it's stable.
Yes.
But if I insert C, so that it collides between A and B, then C will get what B was, and B will get bumped down. So it's probably stable, but there are some degenerate cases where you can get bumped around.
I'm going to start a new club.
Dealt with everything I thought of, it may be possible to break it.
Leave that to an enterprising organization.
Yes.
No.
So there's actually, this is a little bit scary, but we generate a, like,
sick.
66 kilobyte configuration file that contains all the orgs. And the purpose of this is to actually, basically, the key thing here is this rewrite rule. It adds a rewrite rule for every org. Because remember, every org is now a fake user. And so it makes it so that when you request select org slash them, it sends them to the fake user. And so that automatically makes the whole, like, running as the user thing taken care of.
Okay.
It's pretty sick. And you can see what script actually generates it, because I pulled the JHuts. All right. Okay. On club CGI, none of this magic happens. It literally is just club users out of the club password file. So there's this thing called SUExec.
Just a second. None of this magic happens on club CGI, just club users from clubs.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a thing called SUExec, which is what Apache uses to execute scripts with the permissions of a user. The basic idea is whenever Apache needs to execute a CGI, it figures out what the local user that is, and it does this via tilde whomever. And then it runs a setuid root binary called SUExec and gives it some magic arguments, which says, run this script as this user, and it does. This is part of Apache. It's standard procedure, with the caveat that it's slow because it has to do, like, basically a fork and an exec for every CGI. But we don't care. We don't have that much load. We've made a number of modifications to the source code of SUExec. They're kind of scary. The first of these is we remove some. So this thing is written in a very paranoid way. Like, it makes sure that that a script that it's about to execute is only writable by the user that it's being executed as, that it's in a directory that only they can write to, crap like that. Just a lot of sanity checks. We had to remove a lot of these checks because they fail in AFS. In particular, AFS UIDs have no relationship to local UIDs.
Right.
So, stuff like that. In particular, also, a writable directory doesn't mean anything in AFS, because... Like, Unix writable doesn't mean anything. It's
right.
AFS writable. Stuff like that. Yeah. Which you can do, by the way.
Which is the default.
Yes. So there's another bit of scariness, which is it attempts to get Kerberos tickets and AFS tokens if contrib key is set up for your user. Before it executes your CGI.
It comes to get tokens and tickets if...
You're set up for contrib key. And I'm going to say more about contrib key in a minute.
So, is this AFS tickets from Andrew AFS, or from...
This is for a special club principle, which we create for people. I'll explain this in a second.
Okay.
It also sets some Unix R limits, which are basically things like max number of processes for this user, max amount of memory this process can use, stuff like that. So that actually if you write a fork bomb CGI, it won't work. If you write a CGI that attempts to eat all physical memory, it won't work. And the way this is done is there's a CGI limits conf file, which is pretty well documented and basically specifies these limits. My contrib is exempt from all the limits. And you have to, I hope this is in there, but yes. So after modifying this file, you have to run this script, which is actually up in a Andrew contrib internal, God, where is it? I don't know. Oh, crap. What? Eee, crikeys. Ah, okay. So you can see that, like, so var Apache looks suspiciously like Etsy, and this is because we're actually running Debian Apache on this. Anyway. Yeah, so there's an update. Anyways, yeah, so CJ limits. But anyways, so suexec actually reads the .db file. So use the conf file to generate the db file using the update CJ limits program. Anyway,
so
and
when you say string modifications, you mean like quite extensive modifications.
Oh yeah, I think we like tripled the size of the source code. And there's another thing which we just finished on Saturday.
Salts.
While we were doing this. By the way, this is perpetually running, even when I hibernate, and when I unhibernate, it starts going again.
Where is that?
It's an in-joke, I'm sorry. You should spend more time in my house.
You should. You live there.
I said, you're
implying that
you don't spend
more
time there either.
I do, you know, all the cool people. I was like, you live there.
Interestingly, I don't spend a lot of time there.
Anyways, the final thing, which we implemented on Saturday, was it redirects standard error of the CGI it's about to execute to a log file.
Finally,
yes.
Also, why does it have to go into suexec?
Dupe 2, you took 213.
Right.
How else would you do it?
On a higher, like, somebody else can call
it. Where else would you do it?
Suexec is a perfectly fine way of doing it.
It's either that or hack the Apache source code.
Yeah. We can add in a new module if you want.
I'm all for creating a new Apache module.
And so we get to see some awesome messages like, oh, I can't read them. Right, never mind. They're like all inverted and shit. Anyways, but yeah, so Tyler is actually working on a script. Well, actually, so what Tyler is slowly working on is basically an interface so that users can sort of read their log files.
Right.
So it'll be awesome. So basically, like, things like permission to... So it most breakage with CGIs just gives you a 500 server error, which is a really annoying thing. And there's no way to look at it otherwise.
Unless but you're, like...
A club admin, and yeah, you can check the log file. Things like Perl errors, things that suexec was unhappy about, script wasn't executable, any of that stuff will now land in here.
Okay.
There's one thing, which is the most common one... And one that is very difficult to catch, which is if your script works fine, but you forgot your content type header, there will be nothing in this log, and Apache will still give you a 500 server error. We are not sure what to do about this.
As long as we're getting content type.
Yeah. So every CGI script, it's the first thing any CGI script needs to output is content-type:, you know, text/HTML.
Like, no, it's still going.
Yeah. We're about 2/3 into it. So that's that. We're thinking about how to do that. That basically lands... What? God. Oh. It maintains my environment. Well, whatever. It just lands in here in a very useless way.
Yeah.
In fact, it doesn't even give you the, like, full path. It just says index.cgi, you know, and premature end of script headers. It's pretty useless. So, okay, I'll bounce the contrib key real quick. So,
what?
I'll say a few words about contrib key.
Okay.
So, this is the principle that we use for it. It's contrib/the user@club, where the user is like the Andrew username. Via mycontrib, you can set it up. And what that basically does is SSHs into Gallium with an SSH public key, and then runs a very scary setuid script that has a curb admin key tab sitting behind it. And it creates the principle, and then literally spits out a key tab for that principle on standard out, which then mycontrib intercepts and saves to a local file on contrib CGI. It is
everything.
So beautiful.
Is that how that's supposed to work?
What does this get us?
What it gets us
moderate form of security
is all the horror or
no.
This.
Can you say that again so I can write it down?
It's not there.
Okay. I mean, yeah.
That's basically
SSH2 Gallium with pub key.
I guess I don't understand why the users need.
Ah, so here's what happens.
Keys.
So
they already have a user on.
Well, right. So the thing is, in the without this, the user has a local user on the contrib CGI server, and their scripts can run with that permission, but they can't read protected AFS directories. They can't write to AFS because they're running completely unauthenticated in AFS.
Okay. So where are you going to put your database password at?
In particular, if you have a database password in your script, you have to expose it to the world.
Right.
That sucks.
Yes.
So if you have set this up via MyContrib, you'll get a key tab which sits in there, which is owned by MyContrib, because that's who created the file. But extended ACLs exist to let you read it. And SUEXIC actually reads this file and gets basically AFS tokens for it. So that you are now authenticated to AFS as that. And so if you... you have this... You are now authenticated as this user at Club. And so if in Andrewland you FS set a... give permissions to this user, your user, it now has permissions. And so in particular, you can create a directory called, like, you know, database passwords, drop them all in there, and set it so that only this user can read it, and yourself, at Andrew, and then it's secure.
Okay.
It's kind of awesome like that. So this setup is actually, I claim, pretty secure. Gallium is already a...
trusted machine.
Very, very heavily trusted machine.
Yes.
It has our CA on it, stuff like that.
Okay.
What's an admin key tab?
It's basically true. It probably has root in a lot of our machines sometimes as well.
A lot of machines have root in all our machines.
Is Gallium actually that secure of a machine?
It's an alpha, so yeah.
It's an alpha running like pre-Sarge or something.
Yeah.
Any known exploits don't work on it.
Yes, it does. It's also behind a NAT, right? Or no, it's... No.
We just don't allow SSH in from off of CMU network.
CMU or Club?
CMU.
Oh.
I went through way too much work to get my admin principle.
You did!
unless you can crack the SSH. Like.
It's running a vulnerable version of SSH.
Really?
I'm pretty
it's
sure.
It's running pre-Sarge.
So if anybody wants admin,
it's
there's a good
works.
Way to hack it. There's
it's
a machine called Gallium. Go for it.
I mean, noted. If I had known this, like, I would have, you know, I guess I couldn't have netbooted the machine in n equals bin sh because alpha.
If you can
it's
figure out how to
it's
do that
alpha.
On an alpha, you deserve your bits.
Why would you netboot? Because I don't know how to netboot an alpha. I don't know how
to,
like...
You don't need to netboot.
He doesn't know how to boot an alpha.
I just don't know how to, like, poke the bootloader on an alpha.
You have to admit, it's a pretty scary bootloader.
Yikes.
In fact, it's probably... No, it doesn't have a fourth interpreter in it, does it?
No.
Fourth?
That's what Suns have.
It's not open software, guys. It's not open firmware.
The bootloader on Sun hardware has a fourth interpreter in it.
I'm going to
and you can write programs in your bootloader. Okay, sorry.
The bootloader and alpha, I think, is basically a...
So anyways,
control. Okay. Yes, I'm going to take my notes back so you guys don't know what I'm going to talk about. Anyways, MyContrib, as I said, is a virtual host on Contrib CGI, and its root is actually... I love how we have these... So it's...
MyContrib is a vhost on
Contrib
CGI?
Contrib CGI.
Yes.
It's an IP vhost. So the IP is actually bound. The reason these all have different IP addresses is SSL. Anything that's SSL has to have a separate IP address for each vhost because the SSL negotiation happens before you specify your... Well, you do the SSL negotiation, and then you send your request, which includes the host header. And so the server doesn't know which certificate to say it is.
This is
okay.
It's a major flaw in SSL. I believe TLS or some new version of SSL actually has some way of dealing with it, but nobody uses it. Yeah. Since there are an infinite number of IP addresses, nobody cares. There are.
Speaking of which, 2/8 is now valid IP address space.
Lovely.
Remove it from your block list.
Ha! Yeah, right. Anyways, yeah. So if you request www.club/contrib/mycontrib, you'll probably get something, since it's sitting in the club. it probably won't do what it should, but I think it'll actually sort of work. So that's that. So there's this pub cookie thing.
It forwards to mycontrib.
Oh, amazing. You can probably request /mycontrib/, you know, I don't know. Whatever. Anyways, so there's this scary pub cookie thing, which is what, well, it's web ISO, as everybody knows it. Etsy.deleteme.
That's probably Kasich. Yeah.
No, given the hour, that's probably me. the timestamps on these things are terrifying. Anyways, God. Anyways.
Wow, does that work?
What do you mean, does it?
Is it 7 a.m.?
Well, on the same day.
You haven't gone to sleep yet.
I know.
Well, the scary thing
is. I said, does it work?
Is.
I heard, is that work?
No.
VARP? So, like, on that very day, I was working on this at 4 a.m., and then I was also working this at 7 a.m.
Oh.
So, apparently, this is kind of a marathon working on a contrib session.
In January
sometime, yeah. Anyways, yeah, I don't believe in classes, as you can tell. So, there's this pub cookie thing, and it basically operates as an Apache module. And so, there's mod pub cookie. And it's a very large module relative to all the others because it's crap. And so, whoa, that's the extent of our HTTP.com. Okay, the new Apache has things different. So what you saw previously was the old style Apache configuration. This is the new style, which we're trying to gravitate towards. So the way Apache does it now is the Apache conf is tiny, or no, HTTP conf is tiny. Apache 2.conf is big and has all the standard crap, which we barely modified. Then they have sites.
Yeah, sites available.
Sites available, sites enabled, blah, blah, blah. And this is where we have all the specific stuff. All the things you might recognize. Basically, we're trying to gravitate them all towards this setup. Anyways. PubCookie is kind of scary. Let's see. So basically, if you have an Anju SSL certificate for a host that automatically grants you the ability to use PubCookie, you don't need anything else from Anju to set it up.
Okay.
So, like, this is literally the SSL private key for www.contrib, and this is the SSL certificate for www.contrib. And so, using the key client program, which is part of PubCookie, we got a symmetric key for PubCookie, which we dropped in this directory. This is pseudo-documented on the wiki. And then this is just basically the config file. There's a separate one for the... generally... right, because mycontrib has a separate SSL key. Generally, there's a separate PubCookie config for each vhost. For Andrew, we require some special kludges, since they use ancient PubCookie still. And stuff like that. I don't think they've upgraded.
It works.
Yes, this is true. So that's basically that. Literally, that's all we have to do for it. How to use PubCookie is essentially documented on the... yeah. But the essential idea is this. You say you have a .htaccess file which does something like this. The key things are auth type, web ISO, and then something that makes it to require authentication. This one's just valid user.
The app IDs are really...
So mod PubCookie understands what that means?
Yes. These are actually... or, well, mod pubcookie implements this auth type, and then pubcookie star is a config that's implemented by pubcookie. Yeah.
Okay.
Is
pubcookie like just an Andrew thing, or is it used elsewhere?
No, in fact, it's University of Washington or something. Yeah, so if you know Woo FTPD, I think. Or no, is that a different one? That's a different one, actually. Anyways, never mind. Yeah, so they maintain it independently.
With Apache and Microsoft IIS?
That's terrifying.
So pubcookie is the entire, like, you log into web, so on some websites know who you are.
Yeah, yeah. That's good. The final two dangling bits are most of the horrible scripts lie in user local CW script, which happens to be
what is that? What were you saying?
What does CW scripts mean?
Contrib web scripts.
Okay.
Which happens to be a stowed thing. Is stowed.
Has it been updated since 2005?
No, it has. I've been.
But the order just said.
And yeah, these scripts basically work. I'm happy with them. They're reasonably well. They're reasonably sane. But yeah, I'm responsible for this horror. One thing I haven't mentioned, just basically like contrib link users is the one that diffs the entry password file, and then basically sets some links.
And these are listed in cron job somewhere?
Yeah.
Where? On
Every machine that needs it.
Okay.
And then this is the one that... Oh yeah, here's our offset. It's 140,000.
So as long as we don't have 140,000
yes.
pub users? Or
Andrew users.
Oh.
As long as Andrew doesn't... Right.
How, I mean, I assume we're not any more close to that. That'd be really bad if we got hit.
No, isn't it just important that there's not more than 360,000 Andrew users? And there can't be more than 140,000 club users? Because you're worried about
overflowing
the organization.
Well, there's also the problem of if... Yeah. You're right.
Okay.
Sorry. There is a cap on the entry users in the 360. So, whatever. I'm basically terrified of overflowing in int, so it'll be a while. Potentially we should add some more zeros to this.
And that generates etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/etc/ this is...
It actually...
an etc password. Because I know we have a script that generates etc password. Is this different?
This generates password dot contrib. Yes.
Okay.
Which then the other scripts
will
merge in.
Yes.
And merge in with password
yes.
admin and password dot user.
Yes. So it attempts, I believe... Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm not paying attention. Anyways.
It's not important right now.
Yeah. So the final thing is we mirror org tracker, and we do that via these scripts. We have, like, the official org tracker database. We have sort of a fake org tracker database of our own design, and then we merge them to make our utilized org tracker database. And these scripts basically just bounce between SQL servers to do all that magic. Someday, these will also do CGI magic and automatically create vhosts. That'd be really nice. I wish somebody could do that. So that basically, like, so my eventual goal here is to actually have, like, websites for org tracker role accounts, basically. Because the entry org thing is not that. It's sort of an attempt at it. It's a separate thing. But it's basically the same idea. Because that way we could actually, like, officially offer websites to clubs, and they would maintain all the, like, and then people who are officers could manipulate it via my contrib and stuff like that. All would be happy in the world. Like in particular, we could have an AFS volume for each club, and then Perl scripts would actually set permissions so that everybody who's an officer for the club for the Urtech database
right.
gets permissions, stuff like that. And then that just gets updated automatically, you know, from year to year. So that's kind of a to-do I'd like to see someday. The final other thing, and final for real this time, oh, I think I got rid of them. Or am I just confused? I don't know what I'm doing. Oh, good. I don't know. This is deprecated.
What do you mean?
Apache DB keys. Oh, yeah, it doesn't even exist. Okay. Yeah, so there was this thing called DB keys, which is deprecated. It was basically a temporary solution to the contrib key problem, which was basically we would store your database password in a file on the local file system that your CGI could access. So you could actually securely access database passwords that way. We're not doing that anymore. But if you see dangling references to something called DB keys or DB pass, that's what that was. Otherwise, that's it. Sheer misery, but now you all understand the horrible little thing that is contributed.
I'll say it's better than I thought it was.
Yeah, there was only the key tab generation that was truly terrifying.
That is really the only terrifying part of it.
It's so
Sarge.
Old.
This is Sarge. There's no KSU.
God, that's horrible. It's actually pretty scary.
As well as the fact that MKSIC has its own home directory on Dalium as well.
Home! Cool. A bunch of tasks from Magnesium.
So would it be?
So yeah, if you can break that, you basically have it.
All I need is for SSH-agent to core dump on me, and then I can...
Ooh, how about the following?
You can
I will
the key
give a
it.
Challenge to you all. This is an MD5 sum of the private key. Now go break MD5.
So there are ways to break MD5, just not in that quite that way.
More like I can hand it something that I
yes.
know is going to be useful.
All you have to do is generate every possible 668-byte file and check the MD5 sum, and if it's that, you've got it.
So I haven't done this with MD5. I did this with LM a while ago.
I just gave
LM
you an offline dictionary attack.
Right. A dictionary attack against a rather large file.
Slightly.
Yeah, 665 bytes.
Also, why aren't we using like RSA? Why are we using DSA, not RSA?
DSA is strictly better. I have no idea.
Just for this old problem.
Yeah,
probably. I'm trying to find where this lies.
Contrib key. Oh, it's even stowed.
Shock.
Oh God.
Beta.
Which beta are we on? Beta 2.2. The latest one.
Anything else you want to say before I kill the recording?
No.
Redacted.